Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
I got up in the hobbit hole that we live in, you know, underneath the windmill. I lit a candle. Hobbit holes don't have electricity. I looked in the mirror. Man, do I need a haircut. So do you. But we're not politicians. Now, maybe I'll tell you where that hobbit hole is someday. But right now, I'm not going to tell you. Not now. You might want to hang out with me. And there's coronavirus around. Chicago, it's serious. New York, all the big cities, it's serious. You remember when we were told that Chicago isn't Chicago anymore? That it's been transformed? That the old Chicago is gone, like our accents and beautiful vowels? You know, people who talk like this yearn for their words to be the truth. They want Chicago to change. They were lost or intimidated in this tribal political city. They wanted things deconstructed, and they put their faith in their analysis. Yet here's the thing. Chicago is still a Catholic town, a city of parishes and neighborhoods and many faiths, extending out into the suburbs, into Homewood on the south and Highwood on the north, to beautiful Western Springs on the west and on into DuPage. And all of those have Catholic parishes, and all those parishes are shuttered. This is Holy Week for Roman Catholics and Protestants and all the Western Christians, with Easter on Sunday. I'm Greek Orthodox, and we, the Russians, Armenians, Bulgarians, Serbians, and on, have a different tradition. Call it politics. We celebrate Easter later this year, on April 19th. Just a few minutes ago, Zeus the Wonder Dog let me out of the hobbit hole and took me for a walk. And as we were walking, I listened to the most beautiful songs I know. The Orthodox chant of the Lamentations, the ancient songs dating from the 1400s. It's the Lamentations that we sing on Holy Friday. And I stopped in a park and heard the chanters and their lamentations. And I thought on it. What's different this year is that all the churches of the East and of the West are closed at this most holy time of the year. And as such, there's a great sadness. In the Holy Land, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where we believe that Christ rose from the dead, bringing salvation to all humankind, is closed too. I saw the old man, a Muslim family that's been caretakers of it for, I don't know, since the 1100s. And he shut it down with the big keys and they locked it shut. The church hasn't been closed since the 1300s and the Black Plague, but it's closed now. Can we talk about such a thing? Now, you and me? That feeling of loss, of distance during coronavirus, when millions of people, billions, are most in need of spiritual comfort. For a journalist to talk about it, well, I know I'm going to be damned as a heretic by the secular high priests. They never seem to miss a chance to mock Christianity. But I want to. I need to. I think it's necessary. So many of us denied church, denied gathering, denied the sacraments of Holy Communion together. It'll be interesting to see how the secular media, which often mocks the faithful, will handle the coverage. And it makes you realize that Easter really isn't about chocolate bunnies and peeps or brunch and Bloody Marys, is it? It never was about the peeps or the chocolate. These are pagan fertility symbols. These are what are acceptable in the media, the way to discuss Easter, through symbols. The chocolate bunny is the icon. The peep, yellow marshmallow peep, is an icon. That's not it. What people yearn for is something else. Not the food, not the Bloody Marys, not the brunch, not the chocolate, not the peeps. And we realize it when it's taken away from us by coronavirus. We'll get into other things too. Politics, of course. Pritzker of Illinois. And what's going on in neighboring Wisconsin? That hot mess of an election up there, as the politicians give speeches about their virtue and call the other side hypocrites. The barking dogs of politics just won't stop, even in our misery. And the tribes, the Republicans and the Democrats, are now fighting how best to hold the November election with the virus around. I've got an idea, the Chicago way, to help fix it. And Mayor Lori Lightfoot is upset with reporters. Just a week or so ago, wasn't she queen of her own personality cult with that PSA, her stay-at-home PSA, Stay Home, Save Lives? One of her lines to a friend on the phone, one of my favorites, you know, when she was wearing the Sox jersey, she says, getting your roots done is not essential. Stay home. Uh-oh. Guess what? She got her hair done, and now she's angry that reporters asked her. She got a little snippy, and she said, I'm the public face of this city. I'm on national media, and I'm out in the public eye. Okay, Mayor. Okay. Governor Pritzker has great hair, too. I wonder how he keeps his hair so nice. Jeff Carlin, executive producer of the Rokan show on WGN, is here, too. Well, he's not exactly here, but he's at the studio putting all this together. And he's driving that Wayback Machine, chiming in with his own thoughts. I don't know who he's going to pick up. My wife Betty likes it this way. At least Jeff finally gets a chance to talk, she says. And I agree. Plus, you know what? Jeff has great pipes. Great pipes for radio. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, a member of its editorial board, sitting here at the edge of my hobbit hole, enjoying a fine spring morning in relative silence, if it wasn't for the planes going overhead. And where are you? With the churches closed and the barking dogs of politics and media tearing at each other's flesh while the people suffer, and Lori Lightfoot getting a haircut? Is consistency really the hobgoblin of little minds, or what? You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon. And in a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
You know, we're going to get to Easter and Holy Week and what we're doing and what we've lost. But first, can we just clear the field of the barking dogs of politics? They're always barking. Johnny Rocco would love it. Governor J.B. Pritzker, did I say he has good hair? He must have Jeeves the butler trim his locks. He can't hold a news conference without blaming President Trump. You've got to blame somebody, and politicians certainly can't blame themselves for lack of preparation. Just point the finger and shout. And the media, which around here is mostly liberal and democratic, just love it. Because it's easy. Because Governor Pritzker ripped is the first line of many leads. Because it reinforces their beliefs, their deeply held faith that orange man bad. I heard a rumor that there's one conservative columnist in Chicago, just one. Just one? I hear he takes a beating. Poor guy's got to be crazy to do this job. But many of the chattering classes are upset now in a huff that Wisconsin held the election and the Wisconsin Supreme Court, with Republicans, overruled Governor Evers' last-minute move to postpone it. They're all jawing at each other, saying it's dangerous, coronavirus kills, it's irresponsible and worse. Sorry to bring up some facts, but here's one. The Democratic Party campaign of Joe Biden didn't ask to postpone the election, and the Republican campaign of President Trump, who endorsed a Republican for Supreme Court in Wisconsin, didn't have to postpone it, or didn't ask to postpone it. And you know something? All the liberals shrieking now about the voters of Wisconsin being put at risk of the coronavirus and the vote up there. Where were they just days ago? Where were they? When J.B. Pritzker, I know some of you want to call him Governor Toilets, but I prefer the classical description of Governor Commodius Maximus. But where were they when Pritzker insisted that the March 17th Illinois primary take place? Where were they? Crickets. If Pritzker's name was Rauner, they'd have hated on it. But Pritzker? Oh, they forgive Governor Commodius Maximus. Wonder why? You think it could be politics? Now, since I'm the designated skunk at this garden party, let me remind you of something Pritzker said, just in case you're tempted to say, Pritzker didn't know then what we know now about the virus. He knew. He called it deadly. Just the day before the March 17th primary, he held one of those famous press briefings of his. You know, he watches Governor Cuomo's briefings out of New York and then tries the techniques himself. But at that briefing, the day before the March 17th primary, Governor Commodius Maximus was asked a question about all those bar owners in Chicago defying his order against people hanging out in bars for the farewell bash.
But Governor, there's all sorts of bar owners that say that they're going to defy this order that you had. Some are even holding huge, extravagant parties today because they know that some people may not be coming to their establishments and they want to celebrate St. Patty's Day. What do you say to them?
Well, I would say to them that weeks from now, months from now, when one of those partygoers, one of those people that they defied the order to have into their establishment becomes sick, perhaps dire, somebody perhaps that might die, that they should know that they are responsible for that.
Excuse me, Governor Maximus, Governor Commodius Maximus, you said what? If someone becomes sick, perhaps dies, that the people responsible should be held responsible, that they should know what they've done? Well, okay. So, Governor, are you responsible for those who are coming down with the coronavirus now? The ones who voted in the March 17th election? Does Pritzker even want to know whether voters or election judges got infected because he wanted that vote cast and Joe Biden wanted it done? Does anybody make any mention of it? Does anyone care to remind people of what happened? Or is everybody on the same page? Politics, journalism here in Illinois. You know, the same page. That page that says, Orange Man bad. It's easier and it gets clicks. You close churches? So you close churches but not politics? Because politics is the government temple. And elections is the are the tray passed by the high priests. Or do we forget it and just look to Wisconsin? Here's another political development. Joe Biden was wondering over the weekend on ABC if we shouldn't use the coronavirus to reform our election in November, maybe use vote by mail.
I think it's time we start thinking about how we're going to hold elections, whether we're going to have to and spend a lot of time figuring whether we do, is it going to mostly be by mail, which is not the preferred route for everyone? Are we going to, how are we going to do that? How are we going to make it available to everybody?
Trump was asked about it. He wondered why Governor Evers didn't move on this weeks ago. I'm wondering too. But check out what he said about the November election.
Why did he do this 2 weeks ago? All of a sudden, all of a sudden an election, which is taking place very soon, gets delayed. Now, I just endorsed him today, and it was a very strong endorsement. His polls, he's gone very high up. And all of a sudden, the governor comes out, the Democrat governor, by the way, comes out and says, oh, we're going to move this election. So I don't know. I hope you're right.
Do you think every state in this country should be prepared for mail-in voting?
No, because I think a lot of people cheat with mail-in voting. I think people should vote with ID, voter ID. I think voter ID is very important. And the reason they don't want voter ID is because they intend to cheat. When you get something, when you buy something, you look at your cards and credit cards and different cards. You have your picture on many of them, not all of them, but on many of them. You should have a picture on your for voting. It should be called voter ID. They should have that. And it shouldn't be mail-in, excuse me, it shouldn't be mail-in voting. It should be you go to a booth and you proudly display yourself. You don't send it in the mail where people pick up all sorts of bad things can happen by the time they sign that, if they sign that, by the time it gets in and is tabulated. No, it shouldn't be mailed in. You should vote at the booth, and you should have voter ID. Because when you have voter ID, that's the real deal. Thank you very much. We'll see you tomorrow.
So how do we resolve this? The Democrats want to prove they care about people. The Republicans want to prove they care about people, but they think Democrats will cheat, and so they want voter ID. Actually, that doesn't sound all that unreasonable, does it? With so many jurisdictions, Maryland, Virginia, elsewhere, allowing non-citizens to vote in local elections. Yeah, they allow non-citizens to vote in local elections. If people don't have confidence in the vote, that's trouble. Big trouble. Mail-in vote, write-in vote. If you don't have confidence, you know what'll happen? What if Biden wins and half the country starts screaming, not my president, not my president, shrieking and tearing their hair out? That would be terrible. Democrats wouldn't be able to handle it. But I've got a way to deal with this. The Chicago way. The Johnny Rocco way. How about if we let Boss Madigan and Boss Preckwinkle set up commissions to count all the votes for all the country? They could designate independent poll watchers like Dominic Longo and the boys from the Coalition of Better Government to count them. Why not? All on the up and up, right, Johnny? Just count the votes and count the votes. Let Johnny Rocco handle it the Chicago way.
I take a nobody, see? Teach him what to say. Get his name in the papers. Now, pay for his campaign expenses. Dish out a lot of groceries and coal. Get my boys to bring the voters out. And then count the votes over and over again till they added up right and he was elected.
What strange times we find ourselves in. It used to be working at home was a bonus or a benefit or a perk to a job, and now it's almost a scourge. And I count myself lucky because I am a person who still gets to go to work or has to go to work to do my job. And every day, it's weird being out on the streets. I live on the north side of Chicago, and our studios are in downtown Chicago near the river. So every day I drive in and the streets are mostly empty except for a couple of knuckleheads here and there. But I try to take a different route every other day just to see what's going on and see the world. And many times I find myself coming down Michigan Avenue, you know, the Mag Mile. And it's so surreal. It's empty. Normally places that would be filled with bodies going to and fro, tourists, shoppers, police, horse-drawn carriages, which are no longer going to be a thing in Chicago, but that's a different story. And now it's nothing. Now it's empty. It's occasional people. And it used to be, it was so crowded. You'd see people running down the street, jogging for exercise amidst a sea of pedestrians. And now all that's left is just the joggers. And even they are covered head to toe and have a mask on. And it's just bizarre times to think 2 months ago, people were mocking, or 3 months ago now, people were mocking a Chicago representative for proposing a bill that would require someone to pump your gas for you. Almost seems like we need that now, or we want that now. It's just bizarre, strange times. And speaking of strange times, as we do this podcast and under the COVID crisis that's happening, John and I are separated for both our safety. I'm close to getting my home studio up and running so John and I can do some interviews over the phone and with some guests. And hopefully next week we can debut that. But, well, fingers crossed. But in the meantime, we're presenting tape, or I'm presenting tape, that we've done interviews before in the past that I thought were really fun or some of my favorites. And that brings me to the strange times. The interview you're going to hear is an interview we did with Gary Marks a few years ago, right around the time the embargo to Cuba was lifted by President Obama. We decided to bring in Gary because Gary was the bureau chief for the Tribune in Cuba. And during Gary's time in Cuba, Gary got firsthand experience on how strange it is to live under a dictatorship. So without further ado, here's our interview with the great Gary Marks, one of my favorite Tribune reporters who does some great investigative work and was the former bureau chief for the Tribune in Cuba.
And the stories that you did, Gary, were, I would say, balanced. It wasn't, you didn't go in there like a National Review Cuban exile, you know, hitting Cuba for everything they had. You had many different balanced and nuanced stories about the people of Cuba, the difficulties they faced, ham-handed attempts by the United States government to overthrow the regime or to entice doctors out of the country, and still you were kicked out. So here we have Gary Marks. Hello, Gary.
Hey, John.
So tell me about Cuba.
You know, it is such a difficult place to describe and such a difficult place to work. I was one of the few Western correspondents based there. I was there from 2002 to 2007. Before, as you said, they pulled my press credential and said, you're out of here, basically. I think the thing you have to understand is it is a police state. It is an authoritarian government. And really, there is no dissent. What dissent exists on the island, is for the most part kind of corralled. And there are incredibly brave people on the island who have tried to create spaces in civil society, tried to push back against the government. But their lives are incredibly difficult, and most of them in the end end up leaving the island and are forced into exile into the United States or to Spain or someplace like that.
One of our colleagues, Metropolitan editor Mark Jacob, when I told him I was going to have you on the podcast, he mentioned that he had been there recently with his wife to Cuba, and she noticed that there were no boats along the river, along the waterfront. Where were the boats, he said. I said, well, I would assume that you don't want boats there because people get in and leave.
Yeah. I mean, well, obviously you've had tens of thousands of Cubans who've left over the years, and they've risked their lives, and many, unfortunately, have died at sea trying to get to the United States. You know, again, for me, just to give the readers and the listeners an understanding of what it's like, I mean, I essentially was under surveillance all the time, 24/7. I just assumed.
And your family.
Yes, and my family. My late wife and my kids were there at the time.
Cecile was a baseman, was also a journalist as well.
She was, but she was not given press credentials by the Cuban government, so she could not work as a journalist while I was there. But she was incredibly helpful to me in terms of developing stories and understanding the place. She was from Argentina and obviously was fluent Spanish speaker and really, really understood Cuba in a way that is that was difficult for me as an outsider, always being watched to do. Go ahead, John.
But you had, so people understand this, you didn't just cover, you know, the second Area 2 violent crimes and then go over to Cuba. You had spent time in West Africa and other places as well. So you understood the fact that foreign nationals and reporters are often under surveillance, but this must have been ratcheted up.
Yeah, I mean, as you said, I've covered wars, and I spent more than, you know, a decade overseas in Latin America and in Africa, and had seen really bad stuff and reported under tremendously difficult conditions, including, again, covering wars. But this was different. You know, this was a police state where you're being watched all the time. And, you know, when people ask me what it's like, I sort of talk to them. I sort of refer them to that great movie, The Lives of Others. You know, the movie about, I think it was about East Germany, mm-hmm. and about people living in East Germany at the time. And, you know, it really gets into your head when you know your phones are bugged and your emails are being read and your house is bugged, and that the employees you have in your office, which you have to hire through the government, are informants on you. It really presses against your mind. It really becomes claustrophobic in a way that people who've never lived in a society like that don't understand.
And still there were brave people who were willing to speak out at least somewhat before they themselves were jailed or had to leave.
Absolutely. But as a reporter, you know, what I had to do was build a sort of a circle of confidence. I really did. And it took many years to do that, even though, you know, I was reporting all the time. You know, when you see on the phone, on the TV now, and in news, you know, on TV, you see people being interviewed on the street about what they think of Fidel, et cetera, et cetera. You know, frankly, I wouldn't believe a word that they're saying. People who are on the TV, you know, they know the BBC or, you know, which I love or right. whatever. I mean, people who are on camera, for the most part, aren't telling you what they really think. They're telling you what they think you want to hear for one reason or another. And I learned this very quickly in Havana. Hardly ever would I quote people on the street about an important story that if I didn't know them. I built sort of a circle of people that I, in all walks of life, that I trusted. They trusted me, and only then would I sort of get a real feel for what people are thinking.
And those people themselves were under surveillance as well, I would assume, correct?
You know, I had more than one incident where people who I interviewed came up to me afterwards and said state security had stopped by their house and wanted to know what we had talked about and essentially wanted to turn them into an informant. And I frankly had the Cuban government talk to me after, you know, a number of years saying, you know, and I was on their blacklist for a long time because, you know, I wasn't a fellow traveler. And as you said, I worked really hard to come in there with no preconceived notions. I really did.
But you don't do that with any of the stories you write. You don't go in there with an agenda, which I find that many people who scream the media, including me, because I've used that phrase, should understand. There are many journalists who go places or even here in the city that don't go in with a political agenda, and you had none.
Yeah, and I mean, in Cuba, it was just as we all know, it's a lightning rod. It's a lightning rod for the left. It's a lightning rod for the right. I'd spent a lot of time in Latin America, but I'd only been to Cuba once before I was posted there in 2002. And I went there sort of with an open mind. I really did. And I tried to really get deep into the place and write about what people's lives were like. And of course, that had to do with human rights. And the Cuban government just didn't like that.
Before we go into some of the history of what happened there, I must ask you, I watched some of the Useful Idiots talking, Pierre Trudeau and others. And then I saw something from Andrea Mitchell, which I thought, okay, typical, right? Mrs. What's her husband?
Greenspan.
Mrs. Greenspan, as we call her, queen of the establishment. And she was saying something like, well, Fidel Castro, you know, she interviewed a woman on the street in Cuba who was crying, kind of like she could have been crying in North Korea after the death of that dictator, but she was here in Cuba crying. And then she said, but he was such a fascinating man who would stay up at all hours talking about literature and politics. It was very, and I'm trying to get the sense of what is it with the butt kissing of Fidel?
Yeah. Well, I mean, let's talk about it from both sides.
Yeah.
On the one hand, Fidel put Cuba on the map. He did. Cubans are incredibly proud people, and they are very well-educated. And Fidel put Cuba on the map. He defied the United States. He helped bring down the apartheid government in South Africa and helped free, you know, Angola of, you know, colonial rule.
And sent soldiers and
he did. And Cubans died in Angola to fight back the South Africans. And so, you know, and in his own country, you know, he did, with the help of the former Soviet Union, create a healthcare system that for a long time worked, and an education system. And you got to give him credit for that. And many older Cubans are proud of that. But, you know, that stuff, the great part of the revolution in many ways ended with the collapse of the Soviet Union in 89. And when Gorbachev pulled the plug on billions of dollars in aid annually to Cuba, that country has gone downhill, and it really hasn't worked since. And people have basically voted with their legs. You know, they've left the country. Young people, most young people who can leave Cuba. They really do, because there hasn't been a future for them. There hasn't been a way for them to fulfill their dreams. And that's what this government has done more than anything else. It has killed the dreams of many Cubans and forced them to leave the country when they don't want to. It is their homeland. They love the place. There's so much great about it. This government has killed their dreams.
And what about the repression? What about the repression, the tortures, the executions, the gulag that he created, an island prison in the middle of the Caribbean?
Yeah, I mean, most of the executions took place right after the revolution. And but, you know, as I said earlier, you know, you're not going to be executed in Cuba if you dissent against the government now. There hasn't been an execution in a while, but what will happen is, you know, your child is not going to get into a good government school. You know, you're going to lose your government job. You know, you are going to have pressure on you. You may be incarcerated. You may be, you know, harassed by the police all the time. You know, your life is made to be very, very difficult if you speak out against the government, if you speak out against Raul Castro, if you speak out against Fidel. There are going to be repercussions for
even
you.
Even now.
Even today.
So the as Cuba lost its patronage, and, you know, Thatcher's famous comment, socialism is great until you run out of the money, of other people's money. We've noticed that President Obama went to Cuba, tried to open it up. I'm sure the Pritzkers and other hotel companies are happy from the United States to do work there. Who will be the beneficiaries of this new Cuba? I would suggest it would be the, just like Soviet Union became Russia, the KGB and intelligence operatives who were tied into all different parts of the establishment were the ones who rose up economically because they had the information and the leverage. I would assume the same thing is going to happen in Cuba. Is that crazy?
Well, they control the levers of power. I mean, Raul, and again, I have to say, I haven't been back to Cuba since 2010. It's been a while. But Raul, you know, when he took power essentially for good in 2008, when Fidel was ill and stepped aside, since then, he's put in most of his loyalists. And those are former military people, former generals, and they control a majority of the economy right now. They are the political and economic elite. So, are they the ones who are going to benefit from this opening? Yes, they will. The question is, John, and I don't have the answer for you. You know, the question is, will opening up the economy, will it trickle down to the average person on the street? Now, they have allowed some small private businesses. Fidel allowed this after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and they lost those billions. But when the Venezuelans step in and Hugo Chavez stepped in with 100,000 or 150,000 you know, gallons of, you know, barrels of free oil, then they sort of clamp down on those people. So they open up when they need to, and they clamp down when they don't need to. Right now, Venezuela is in big trouble, yes, as we know.
Right.
That economy is collapsing.
Not even toilet paper. They're starving.
Yeah. I mean, and people are leaving.
Right.
There was a great story in the newspaper, in the New York Times this weekend about Venezuelans fleeing by the tens of thousands. So, you know, the question is, are they going to open up more? Is there leverage to open up more? Who will benefit? But the levers of power right now are still in the hands of the military elite and of the political elite.
What about you personally? I was struck by your story about being the feeling of being constantly under surveillance. What was it like personally for you to be there? And what happened? Were you jailed like I was told?
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't use the word jailed, but I was detained many times. And so what would happen is I would go into a small village. I was doing a story in the countryside. I would go into a small village, and I knew that I had probably about 1 hour, a golden hour, so to speak, where I could interview people.
Before
somebody on the street called the police, called the intelligence services, and then I would be brought, then they would make a huge sort of show.
Really?
Yes. And I would be brought, you know, they'd take me away.
One car or two?
You know, whatever. Two. Three. But whatever. Yeah. You're in a small village. The right. police show up. People are really scared. And you know, they would take me in, and they were very nice. I had my press credentials. They would ask me what's in my notebook. They couldn't read English. My handwriting is, you know, scribble.
Legendary scribble.
Exactly. Okay. And so, you know, I said, I'm here legally. Here's my press credential. Call up the foreign ministry. They know I'm here. You know, and then they would release me after an hour or 2 hours or something like that. But my day of reporting in that town was over. Nobody would talk to me really after that. And this happened over and over again. It happened on the day Fidel got ill and I went out into the plaza to interview people. I actually had forgotten my press credentials up in my office.
Boy. Yeah.
I stepped right outside and, you know, they took me away and held me for 4 or 5 hours. They were very nice.
Did they offer soda or snacks?
No soda or snacks. But, you know, it wasn't like I ever felt physically threatened. Never, you know. But they sort of made my job incredibly difficult.
And then you were kicked out of the country.
Yes. Well, they pulled my press credential and said I couldn't work there anymore. And, you know, if I can't work anymore there, I gotta leave the country. But again,
what was your great sin? Because you were doing stuff at that time about the United States government with these ridiculous, let's put it this way. Whenever you start a federal program, it gets really huge.
Yeah.
And it turned like, let's get rid of Castro turned into stereos and video games going to Cubans in Miami. Explain
that. Well, this was a State Department program that, essentially was, you know, spending, I forget what it is now, tens of millions of dollars a year to supposedly provide aid to the dissidents.
Right.
And, you know, of course, some of the dissidents turned out to be government agents. Some were incredibly brave people who were actually trying to write stuff and send it to Miami to get it published to try to, you know, show people outside of Cuba, because Cubans inside can't read these websites, of course. Many don't have access to the internet. Tell them what's going on in the country. So I wrote about that. I wrote about the, you know, the waste and the fraud about that. And I, like I said, I tried to be
on
really
both sides.
Yes, I tried to be very balanced. But they, you know, I wrote one story. I think that was sort of what I heard later, and I'll tell the story briefly. So I wrote a story about it was the 50th anniversary of the founding of the FAR, the Revolutionary Armed Forces, and I remember this was after Fidel had been sick and had temporarily ceded power in 2006 to his brother Raul, and Raul hadn't appeared in public. Fidel turned over power in July 2006. This was December of 2006, and Raul had never appeared in public, never said what he was going to do to the, you know, Cuban people. And then they were going to hold this huge march, which they did with tanks and artillery.
Right.
And I wrote a story, you know, the day, you know, that it was published the day of that thing, saying, you know, Cubans, and this is true, Cubans didn't want to see tanks. They didn't want to see this march. They wanted to know how Raul Castro was going to improve their lives economically. That's what they wanted. And I remember the headline of the story, which I did not write, as you know, John.
Blaming the copy editor once again.
It was a great headline. Right. It said, "The parade is a charade."
Oh, well, I'm sure he wasn't happy with that.
And I remember that I got to the parade. I went to it. You know, I had to check in with a foreign ministry. And I remember the guy who handled the foreign press. I saw him. He would not even shake my hand. And for Cubans, that is the biggest insult you can do in Latin America. You know, even people you disagree with,
in the eye,
you look a man in the eye, you say, "How are you?" You say, "How's your family? How are your kids?"
Right.
That's the way Cubans are.
Right.
And he didn't shake my hand. He looked at me for a second, and I sort of knew that was the beginning of the end for me.
That's a big difference from the story that I'd read recently where Fidel himself was reading a story you had written in the Chicago Tribune. I think it was about a dissident in Miami. And this is the quote. Of course, it's not that I read The Nation all the time. I read The Nation so you don't have to. But the quote is, here's Fidel reading a story from the Tribune. "In reality," and then he looks at the byline, "in reality, I give thanks to the reporter, Gary Ma." Then he hesitated. Then he continued with surprise in his voice. "His name is Marx. Compadre, even more respect for the reporter. His name is Gary Marx, and in reality, this newspaper is an organ that tries to say some things."
Yeah. Well, that was it.
Did you say, "Yeah, my great-grandfather was Karl Marx," just to get into it?
Well, the interesting thing is that, Fidel said this on national TV, and up to that point, I knew that I couldn't get any interviews with government officials. It was very difficult. They knew I wasn't sort of a fellow traveler, but I felt like I was reporting.
Clearly, you're not, since I know you.
Right.
You're not.
Tough, but fair.
Gary's one of the few people at the Tribune that'll actually talk to me.
Yeah.
All right.
So the funny thing is the foreign ministry, I was on, obviously, their blacklist and couldn't get interviews. And so Fidel gets on TV and he's reading all the foreign press coverage of it. This guy wasn't an activist. The guy I wrote about was a terrorist, a former CIA operative who had been accused and was probably responsible for bringing down a Cuban airliner in the 1970s that killed
the Nation.
200 people.
Okay,
or so
The Nation
like
called him a terrorist, so I didn't know what to say.
Yeah, no, he was.
Right. He was a terrorist.
And so this guy shows up in Miami. His name is Luis Posadas Carriles, and says he wants political asylum. I don't want to get into the whole story, but I flew immediately to Miami because this guy held a small press conference. And I interviewed the guy. I wrote a straight news story. And then Fidel, of course, this is in 2003. Fidel is in a rage because he's saying George Bush is talking about the war on terrorism in Iraq and they're invading. And here is a guy who's a terrorist who brought down an airliner and he's asking for political asylum in the U.S. So I wrote a straight story, including in the story, I quoted this guy's attorney saying that Fidel Castro es un tirano. Fidel Castro is a tyrant. So Fidel is on TV for 5 days in a row. Of course, it's all state controlled.
Right.
Railing
no commercials.
No commercials.
Right.
It's just Fidel 24/7. So he's on and he's reading all the foreign media and he gets to my story, which was second. And I'm in my office at 9 at night. Listen to this. I call my wife. I say, "Get ready, sweetheart. Turn on the TV because we may be kicked out tonight." And so he begins reading the story and I think he reads the lead and he says, "This guy, it's a pretty good lead."
Right.
And Fidel comments about everything. Right. And so takes him an hour and a half to read the thing. In fact, he's on live TV in front of all these generals and all these Communist Party officials. And he even reads the quote that says, "Fidel Castro es un tirano," is a tyrant. And he starts laughing. And of course, the camera pans to the generals who are sitting in the audience, like 300 people in uniforms, and nobody even moves. They're petrified.
They don't know whether to laugh.
Exactly.
Right, because they know they've been killed.
Or keep their mouth shut.
Right,
and so he ends up going through the story, and at the end he says, it's a pretty good story. And then he says what you wrote.
Gary Marx.
Right. And the kicker to this is that the next day at 7 a.m., I get a call from the Cuban Foreign Ministry, the official who's responsible for the foreign press, who said literally the first words were, "Can we be friends?"
Mr. Marx.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Because, right. So I got the endorsement of the comandante.
And you went to see him?
I went to see him.
Did he shake your hand?
And I said to the guy, he said, "What can we do for you?" And I gave him a list of the 10 interviews with government officials I had not gotten. And he also said to me, what can we do for your wife? You know, we know she doesn't have a press credential. What can we do for your children? I said, you can do nothing for me.
Right.
But here are, because I knew the room was wired with a camera.
Sure.
And
the same thing, if you go in the mayor's office and ask for your family, it's, you know,
listen,
it's wired too.
Ron,
here in Chicago.
Right. Ron plays hardball. Right, I know that. Right. And I said, no, but here are the 10 interviews I couldn't get. Can you get me these interviews, including one with Fidel? Didn't get me the interviews, but it turns out I later learned that Fidel's comment on TV, you know, bought me another 2 or 3 years in the country.
I made a joke about the Karl Marx thing, and so did Fidel Castro. But are you related to Karl Marx?
I'm not related to Karl Marx, even though my daughter, who's in college, wishes we were, because it's very cool. She goes to one of those liberal leading colleges in the East Coast.
Yes, I know about them, and I'm on guard, but that's okay. Okay, the children, they have to fly and then come back home. Okay, that's how it works.
I get it. Yeah.
Also, you know, one thing I have to mention about your stay there, what about sport? You wrote stuff on baseball.
I did stuff
on sport as
well. Yeah, and in fact, I wrote, you know,
boxing?
one of my favorites. Yes, I love boxing, and of course, you know, Cuba is known for boxing and for baseball. And of course, I was really interested in the Soviet or East German sort of system and how it was graft onto Cuba, and you know they have tremendous athletes. So I wrote stories. One story was about, you know, Teofilo Stevenson,
yeah,
the great Cuban boxer, and you remember him. He was
heavyweight champion.
He was the Olympic gold medalist,
right?
Two or three times over.
World heavyweight champion, amateur boxer. He was the amateur champion of the world,
right?
And he never fought professionally.
Correct, and that was the big question. And that, you know, I found this guy. And, you know, I wanted to sort of find out, you know, what happens to old Soviet sports heroes. And, you know, and the big question, of course, for boxing fans is, could he have beaten Muhammad Ali? And,
no.
And so, you know, no. Well, that's what Angelo Dundee said when I reached him,
right,
the late great trainer. But, you know, again, I found this guy, and, you know, he was, I got to say, a very interesting person. He was also a heavy drinker and, you know, kind of a womanizer. And he was also hitting me up for money. And, you know, of
Stevenson
was.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, I put that in the story.
Yeah.
You know, I just said, and that wasn't the big part of the story. But, you know, when
expect a warrior priest for communism?
It's
sleeping on a Spartan cot.
Exactly.
Oh, I can't wait for my next opponent.
Exactly. Right, right. And, you know, and yeah. I tried, you know, so, of course, the story ran. And that wasn't a big part of it. This guy's an incredible human being and a great figure and stuff like that. But I put that in there. And of course, you know, I get the call
from
the foreign ministry, the Cuban government. You know, what are you doing? You know, slandering our great hero, our great sports hero. And I just said, listen, you know, in the Western media, you know, our sports heroes are human beings with their flaws and their strengths. And I said, you know, that is my job as a reporter. I'm going to tell it like it is, and this is who Teofilo Stevenson is. But they just didn't get it. They didn't understand that.
Gary Marx, thanks for being here with us today. Gary, glad you're back back in the United States, and we'll talk soon, okay?
Thanks, John. It's been a pleasure.
I took a walk with Zeus the Wonder Dog, or he walked me. He has to hit every tree. I don't know. It's crazy that way. We walked for a long time, alone, walking for miles. When we got to a park, I sat on the edge of it in a chair, or one of those park benches. We have a lot of parks in the Shire for the hobbits. And I listened to Orthodox chant, the lamentations that are sung in the churches, in the Orthodox churches on Holy Friday. They date back 1500 years. These are the oldest and most beautiful songs I know. But one thing is different. The churches are closed this year, aren't they? Politicians, elected officials have said we shouldn't gather together. gathering together as part of going to church. Now, I've been covering politics a long time in Chicago. One of the traditions here is mixing politics and religion. Harold Washington would hit 6 or 7 churches on a Sunday, and I'd tag along, and we'd eat chicken and beans and okra at almost every one after church, sit with the congregants, talk to the pastor, and move on. I remember him saying, "Don't eat so much chicken. You're going to get fat." The marriage of Democrats and churches in urban areas, black churches, mean that politicians campaign at those African-American churches, campaign for votes there, where worship and politics is often woven together. Journalists from Chicago and those from the Washington Beltway, people I call the Democratic media complex, who cover urban politics, cover those stories too. Jesse Jackson at the pulpit, or Al Sharpton at the pulpit, or some perhaps not as political clergymen at the pulpit talking politics. Journalists never question that. Never. It's tradition. There's never any snark about separation of church and state, and they don't ever roll their eyes when a respected African-American clergyman has got his arm around a mayoral candidate. Nobody rolls their eyes. They wouldn't dare. But the other day at the White House in a coronavirus briefing where private industry CEOs were talking about how they're manufacturing gear to help fight the virus, Mike Lindell stood up. You know, Mike Lindell, the pillow guy. And he said he was converting his MyPillow factory to make 50,000 masks a day. And he praised Trump, and he praised the Lord. And many went absolutely and hatefully insane, many in the media, because he dared put Trump and God in the same passage, in the same speech. Now, I don't consider the president a religious man. I don't know him, but it just doesn't seem like him. And I don't know Lindell, but Lindell is a former crack addict who found Jesus. He's religious. He changed his life. And they ripped him mercilessly. The usual liberal pundits mocked him, disparaged him. It was quite depressingly vicious. You can see the saliva dripping from their Twitter teeth. But they never mock a storefront preacher hugging a Democratic candidate. You never hear their eyes roll when an athlete being interviewed praises the Lord for helping him score a touchdown. But with Lindell, who's about making masks to wear during the coronavirus, you could hear their eyes rolling. Their eyes popped out of their heads. They sounded like heavy ball bearings rolling around in a tin pan. They rolled around in there for quite some time. But that was days ago. And you know, the 24/7 news cycle, everything changes. And now it's Holy Week. And the high priests of secular journalism and politics will step back from the mocking for a day or so. And they'll offer sensitive takes on people of faith locked out of their churches at this most desperate time. It is desperate. The word for church is ecclesia, meaning an assembly or a gathering. And from this comes ecclesiastical, and so on. 2,000 years ago, they huddled in catacombs. And in the 300s, the Byzantine emperor Constantine and his mother found the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the place where Jesus was resurrected. The one I mentioned at the top of this podcast. They founded it, and now it's closed. This virus isn't the Black Plague of the 1300s, but then the churches are closed just the same, just as they're needed. I don't know if this is about another great awakening, but there's a yearning for ecclesia, a yearning to be together in worship.
a yearning to be together in Holy Week, and it's not happening. I guess we want what we're denied. I know this to be true because I love chocolate sodas. But diabetics are denied the taste of chocolate sodas, like the one they make at Margie's Candies and Western. Real soda, real fizz, real cocoa, real sugar. When you're denied it, you think about it. But that's something stupid like chocolate sodas. This is something deep and important, like faith and communion with each other and communion with God, worshiping together at a time of great stress and anxiety, as those refrigerator trucks park next to the hospitals, people you know become ill. If you're afraid, not for yourself, then you're afraid for those you love, your kids, your parents, your friends. For some of us, for some Christians, what was taken for granted now becomes all the more precious. Church on Sunday may have given way to sports, may have given way to hanging out with your friends at a restaurant, having Bloody Marys and having brunch, may have given way to watching those Sunday talk shows, you know, the ones that everybody has to watch to get into your tribe. And now we realize what's precious: to kneel in a pew with your family beside you, bowing your head in the last days of Lent, the stages of Holy Week, feeling the weight of the gaze down upon you from the heavens. And as you whisper to yourselves, Kyrie eleison, Kyrie eleison, Lord have mercy. But in a church or not, or at home, looking at Mass or liturgy or services on something as sterile as a laptop, the Easter message is the same. The Lamb of God sacrificed for all of us. The refrigerator trucks outside those hospitals, the ones that wait for the dead, these are temporary. They're frightening, yes, but they're temporary. But the light of a candle in the darkness, that's eternal. The light expands, traveling through time and space to where it is most needed. It's not about fertility symbols, about chocolate bunnies and marshmallow peeps and brunch, Easter bonnets, clothes, shoes. It's not about that. It's about something else. It's about the eternal. It's about one who came here 2,000 years ago to suffer for us and redeem us. That's what it's about. For Jeff Carlin and Christine and their families, for Betty and our sons, my brothers, my mom, and me, happy Easter, everyone. And I hope you join us next time for another edition of the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.